From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in March when African-American lawmakers in New York blocked Governor Cuomo's push to legalize marijuana in New York State. As reported by the New York Times, those lawmakers warned that the governor's proposal could perpetuate the racial inequality that exists under current drug laws. 10 states and the District of Columbia have legalized recreational marijuana, and New York could be next. Legalizing the drug could generate about $3 billion in the state, and many advocates are pushing for measures that would ensure at least some of that profit benefits communities that are disproportionately affected by arrests and incarceration for possessing marijuana. Lawmakers are studying the successes and failures of other states when it comes to the issue, and they say one mistake in particular stands out. None of the states or Washington, D.C. enforced measures that would ensure that the profits be shared by minority communities. Assemblywoman Crystal People Stokes, the first African-American woman to serve as Assembly Majority Leader, has taken up the push for an economic equity program. She introduced a bill that would direct half of all marijuana revenue to a community fund that would support programs for communities affected by criminalization. This hour, we discuss what potential legislation along these lines might look like, how it would work in practice, who should be at the table when it's being crafted, and what social and economic supports that the advocates think it should include. Let's welcome our guest for the hour. Mohini Sharma is lead organizer at Metro Justice. Mohini, welcome back to the program.
Thanks so much for having me again.
Robert Hoggard is here. Rob is a board member for Metro Justice. Rob, welcome to the program. Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much.
Also with us is Mary Kruger, executive director of Rock Normal. Mary, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
And Steve Vandewall, deputy chief of Rock Normal. Steve, welcome to you.
Good to be back. Thanks for having us.
And Mary, just a brief explanation of what Rock Normal is one more time.
Rock Normal is the Rochester chapter of the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws. We are a cannabis consumer advocacy organization.
Okay, so listeners, if you got questions and comments about legalization, which does seem, if you look at polling has, like a lot of things, shifted a lot in the last decade. There's certainly strong public support for legalization. 10 other states, D.C. have done it. So it could be coming to New York State. And if you've got thoughts to share, you can do that. We're going to focus a good portion of this program, though, on the question of what economic justice really looks like. And I'll start with Mohini on this question. You've heard the governor talking more about it, especially in recent months. I want to ask, first of all, if you really believe that economic justice is coming if legalization happens, if you trust the powers that be to pursue it that way.
No, I don't trust the powers that be to pursue it that way. And that's why Metro Justice has always invested in building mass social movements of impacted people. So I think if we really want to have a socially and economically just marijuana legalization policy and implementation in New York State, what it means is that we have to build a base of people of color, of low-income people, of working class people that are willing to take bold action and organize in their communities and to pressure Albany to make sure that this happens, and that's the only way it's going to happen.
And Mohini, with the governor's comments more recently, you know, you go back to the campaign, you go back to some of what he has sort of evolved from. Do you feel like these are genuine comments about economic justice, or do you think he's been pushed in that direction?
I think Governor Cuomo often needs a lot of pushing, and I definitely think he's been pushed in it. Historically, a lot of the progressive measures he's taken has been when pushed by movements, especially, and with allies within the legislature on our side as well. Like with the Fight for 15, you know, he was against it for a very long time until masses of fast food workers went on strike and testified at hearings. And that's when he moved further to the left and actually gave working people the wages they deserve. I think it's going to be the same deal here.
Okay. Rob, are you optimistic that economic justice is coming if legalization of marijuana happens on the recreational level?
No, I agree with Mohini. We got to push for it. It won't happen unless we push for it. It won't happen if folks show up and say what we're missing in Rochester and in the state is the political will to do something and to do the right thing by people. What we're seeing is we've had a criminal justice system that has been built to take up where slavery has left off. And we have to repair the harm that has been done to communities of color. And the only way to do that is to pass this bill that makes sense and that supports programs, job training programs, and releases this stigma behind people of color. Because drug dealers are not going to be drug dealers, but they're going to be small business owners. You know, and we have to really think about what that means and have the programs ready to acclimate people into the workforce.
All right. As we turn to our other guests, I'll mention to our listeners, this conversation is part of a series of reporting about the potential impact of marijuana legalization in New York State. And you can find more stories, videos on our website, WXXINews.org. You know, Mary, when it comes to economic justice, what does that mean from your perspective on the issue of marijuana legalization?
It means having equity and diversity in the industry and actually having legislation that supports that equity and diversity. So not just at the surface level, which is what we saw in the CRTA, the Cannabis Regulation and Taxation Act, that was proposed by the governor with the budget that was trying to get pushed through. It didn't have enough of the supports that we need to see beyond the priority licensing that we have seen in other states to try and promote the diversity and equity within the industry. But we need like incubator programs that also support folks beyond the licensing. So having the connection to like legal services and just networking opportunities that you might have to travel to Colorado to get otherwise that you could have in this incubator. And then also the access to actual capital. So this isn't like traditional businesses. You can't just go to a bank and get a loan. A lot of the businesses come from venture capital right now because of the federal illegality of it. So we also have to have legislation that supports that, which we do see the framework for in the MRTA, the Marijuana Regulation and Taxation Act, which is the bill that Crystal People Stokes sponsored in the Assembly, Senator Liz Krueger in the Senate. We're hoping to see that strengthened even more.
Okay. Steve, what does it mean from your perspective?
Economic justice for me means giving everybody an equal opportunity to be a part of this industry. And there's no reason that everybody shouldn't have an equal opportunity. This is a huge sandbox that everybody should have the opportunity to play in. I mean, just think of all the business opportunities that come with this industry from seed to sale, you know, growing and cultivation, extraction, retail, manufacturing. This is a huge industry, and there's no reason that all people, black, white, low-income community, people from low-income communities shouldn't have an equal opportunity. We look at to Colorado as really kind of the staple of a great economic community where they've, you know, raised billions of dollars in revenue from this industry. But the one thing that they didn't address was social and economic justice. We need to be able to take these other systems that have worked, both financial systems, agricultural systems, and be able to wrap them in a social justice blanket. And to me, that's what I think will be perfect legislation.
Now, Mohini, just to kind of make sure that we're square on why this is needed in the first place. There's a lot of talk about disproportionate arrests, and there's a lot of data. I mean, it is a reality in terms of possession arrests, in terms of incarceration. But do you want to kind of elaborate a little bit on that before we kind of get into more of the specifics here?
Absolutely. So, you know, the fact that marijuana prohibition disproportionately affects people of color, it's not just rhetoric. Like, there are numbers to support this, particularly in 2017 in upstate cities, including Rochester, Syracuse, Albany, Buffalo, and Yonkers. Black people were 12.1 times more likely to be arrested for marijuana possession than white people, and Latino people were 6.4 times more likely. And in the city of Rochester specifically, from 2010 to 2018, 1,396 people were arrested for low-level marijuana possession. However, 92% of those arrests were black and Latino, and it gives us the fifth highest rate in the state. And black and Latino folks made up 92% of the arrests, even though the Census Bureau estimates that the population of Monroe County is 77% white.
Well, let me kind of go over some of what we have seen in other states, because our guests have referenced that a little bit, and I think it's useful. And this is from New York Times reporting, and I'm going to kind of go state by state on what we know here. In Colorado, black entrepreneurs said that they were banned from winning licenses because of marijuana-related convictions. So think about that. You get convicted on a marijuana charge, then marijuana gets legalized, and you're told you can't participate in the industry because what is now legal, you did. And so in Colorado, they organized on those grounds. Black citizens make up just a handful of the thousands of cultivation or dispensary license holders there, as Steve was mentioning, and they continue to be arrested on marijuana-related charges at almost three times the rate of white people in Colorado. In California, several cities introduced equity programs, but they did it retroactively. Oakland now requires, for example, at least half of the licenses to go to people with a cannabis-related conviction and who fell below an income threshold. In New Jersey, where the legislature is also weighing legalization, a coalition of mainly black pastors, the NAACP, and advocates is also pushing for legalization only if tied to community reinvestment. After lawmakers in November moved the bill through a committee, the state's chapter of the ACLU called adding language about education and job training a top priority if they're going to go forward with that. Congressional Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez recently called for affirmative actions in licensing for entrepreneurs of color in the marijuana industry, and Senator Cory Booker of New Jersey, another presidential candidate, has introduced a bill to legalize marijuana nationwide. It's co-sponsored by four other Democratic presidential hopefuls, including New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, and it does include some provisions for job investment in minority communities. So different approaches in different places, but most of the actual work in states where there's legalization is kind of retroactive. If that and let's go around the table. Mohini, if that happens here, in other words, if legalization happens with no sort of parameters for economic justice, can you go back after the fact and really get it done?
I think it's a lot harder to go back and amend something that's already been like pushed through the legislature and is law now. We've seen that time and time again, is that if you're going to legalize something, if you're going to push a policy, do it the right way right from the start. And, you know, for the Start Smart Coalition in New York that's fighting for the Marijuana Regulation and Taxation Act, this isn't an abstract notion. We've actually put forth very, very specific requirements for what that looks like, including that 50% of the revenue of a legal marijuana industry needs to go to a community grants reinvestment fund that shall provide job training, promote adult education, support youth development programming, establish or expand community centers, bolster reentry services for the formerly incarcerated, because we're also saying that criminal records need to absolutely be expunged for marijuana-related convictions, and that having a drug-related offense should not influence your ability to participate in the legal industry. And in addition to that, we're also saying that 25% of the revenue should go to supporting the State Department of Education to keep public schools open and provide a quality education. And we know that inner city schools, which are predominantly low-income families and students of color that, you know, that are going to them, we know that they're severely underfunded, and that sets up an unequal economic opportunity right from the start. So any revenue from marijuana legalization needs to also help public schools, in addition to the remaining 25% going to drug treatment programs and public education campaigns.
Okay, and so it sounds to me, and I don't want to infer too much here, that you are supportive of what Assemblywoman Peoples-Stokes' bill does, yes, on the community fund?
Absolutely.
Okay, is that true for everyone at the table?
Yes.
Okay.
I'll just add that we, both Rock Normal and Metro Justice, are part of the Start Smart Coalition led by Drug Policy Alliance. And Drug Policy Alliance has been working with Assemblymember Crystal Peoples-Stokes and Senator Liz Krueger since 2013 on this bill. So that rhetoric that we heard when the budget was trying to get passed, where Governor Cuomo was saying, "We just started talking about this." No, we didn't. We've been talking about this for 5 years, and we have leaders in the Senate and the Assembly who know this issue, and they're really strong allies of ours, and we do trust the work that they're doing, but it's the governor and his intentions that we're definitely concerned about.
And Mohini, just kind of on dividing the pie, just to make sure that we understand this here. So under this kind of a system, 50% of profit, right, money made, goes to this community fund. And then how would the rest of it break down?
So 50% of the tax revenue.
Of the tax revenue.
Right, would go to the Community Grants Reinvestment Fund, 25% to supporting public education and public schools, and then the remaining 25% to drug treatment programs and bolstered public education.
So that's where tax revenue is going. Go ahead, Mary.
And that was a big issue with the CRTA, the bill that was trying to get passed through with the budget, was Governor Cuomo. That bill, it was proposed that the money was just going to go to, I forget what it's referred to as, but it's pretty much just a generic fund that gets to be decided on afterwards. And that's what the Senator Liz Krueger and Assemblymember Crystal Peoples-Stokes were saying. We really have to earmark a significant amount of this tax revenue to go to communities that have been directly impacted.
How many proposals, whether they are on a national level, and for example, I'm trying to remember, I think it was Andrew Yang, Democratic candidate, talking about expunging records, at least to the extent that you could do it on a federal level. A lot of the charges would not necessarily fall under that purview. But how much of the language and how much of the legislation proposals, whether on state or federal levels, do talk about expunging? What do we know about that? Mohini, Rob, do we know much about expunging of records?
So the Marijuana Regulation and Taxation Act absolutely talks about it and wants it to be automatic. The governor's proposal, which was the Cannabis Regulation and Taxation Act, which was in the budget and didn't go through, didn't actually provide for that. It said that people that have convictions can appeal that decisions within 3 years or so, but it wasn't automatic expungement and it wasn't full expungement, which was a real problem.
Okay, so let me also kind of hit a listener's point in just a moment. I got an email from a listener named Andrew who says, it sounds like no one would be allowed to make any money under New York system. Well, that's not what I'm hearing, but I'll have our guests address that in a moment. But kind of staying on the state theme, you know, Rob, when you look at Colorado as an example, that seems to be a real cautionary tale, because if you literally have entrepreneurs who have, let's say, an incarceration or an arrest for possession, being told you cannot participate in industry where that is no longer a crime. And when you actually look at who is participating, it's extremely white. Mm-hmm. That to me is a pretty good cautionary tale, because we're not talking about people with, you know, violent arrest records, and we're talking just about the disproportionate arrests for possession or drug usage. And so what to you is sort of are sort of the cautionary tales that stand out? What are your biggest concerns here if New York doesn't address these up front?
Yeah, I think the biggest concern is, like Colorado, we could box out communities of color from economic access, right? And so what we really need to do is have a bill that has teeth. And in order for the bill to have teeth, we have to figure out how can we redistribute wealth in this state. You know, when you look at the things that are happening in this state, when you look at we're one of the poorest cities in the country, right? When you look at we're in a skills crisis, a jobs crisis. When you look at we have according to Stanford University, one of the worst education systems in the country. And so when you look at all, we're last in almost all of these metrics, right? And the power of this bill and the power of what we need to do in this country, we have to just address these issues that we have been ignoring for decades, right? We have one of the most progressive state legislatures. It's now time to right the wrongs that we've done in the past decades and stop boxing out communities of color when we talk about economic access, who gets skills, and who has access to all of the money.
All right, it's 844-295-TALK. Listeners, if you want to call the program, that's toll-free, 844-295-8255. It's 263-WXXI if you're calling from Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program, connections@WXXI.org. Let's go around the table. I'll start with Steve. Andrew says, sounds like no one can make any money under these proposals.
I think the MRTA is designed to build communities from the ground up and to reinvest into communities as a whole rather than individuals' wallets. When you start talking about community reinvestment funds and incubator programs and getting people who wouldn't normally have access to this industry, giving them financial resources, workforce resources, human resources, skills training, all the necessities that you need to build a strong, equitable, inclusive industry, using that tax money to put back into systems like that seems like the most logical thing to do, because we're historically a band-aid society. This is a long-term fix, right? You talk about, oh, we have a poor education system, we have high poverty. Well, when you start pumping, you know, tax revenue back into these communities that have been devastated and are directly affected by these issues, we can start to see that you're going to start watering the plant. You know, you start from the roots, and you know, ironically, we're talking about a plant. So it's like we funnel money into these communities, into these cities, and we're not going to build individual wealth. We're going to build wealthy communities and cities. So yeah, I think entire communities and cities are going to benefit financially from this bill.
Okay, Mary?
I think that the cannabis industry is difficult to make money in right now when starting out. It's federally...
Why is that?
It's federally illegal, so the taxes that you're dealing with at the federal level are really, really high. There's some businesses that are paying upwards of 70% in their taxes. And that's on like all of the money that they're making, because they're not able to write off a majority of things that normal businesses are able to write off. Our legal advisor can speak a lot better to it, but it's difficult to make money in the cannabis industry. But what Mohini was speaking to, the 50% going to the community reinvestment, 25% to education, and 25% to drug and alcohol treatment, that's tax revenue. That's not money that's being taken away from the business. That's money that's going to the state regardless of how the businesses are making their money, and that doesn't affect if people are making money or
but
not.
But just to kind of to clarify that point then on the tax revenue, we've seen a lot of the scale of taxation change for cigarettes, for example, over the years. If New York passes this, but we don't see a federal change, what kind of taxes do we expect when you're purchasing cannabis early on?
We expect there to be reasonable taxes. We can't see what New York State has historically done and tax things really high because this market is going to be driven by consumers, and we already have a market that we're going to.
But what's reasonable?
Steve?
I'll tell you what's not reasonable, and we can look to city or states like California, who have thrown a 30% excise tax on there. This is an industry that's been around for decades, and when you start taxing something that people have had access to for decades, people are going to flock to the illicit market. So we have to find that happy medium between taxing appropriately, where we can really generate economic wealth and community wealth for these communities without taxing too high. Because the second you tax you know, this industry too high, people are going to flock to the illicit market. So it's really finding a balance.
Okay. Mohini?
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with what Steve and Mary are saying here. And, you know, the fine-tuning can always be figured out, right? Like, the first step is to actually do this and do this right. And what I also will add is that right now the current proposals, especially the MRTA, are saying that marijuana should be regulated under the same governing body that alcohol is. So it's possible that we actually tax the legal marijuana industry the same way we tax alcohol.
Okay. Rob, you want to add to that?
Yeah, I think we have to really look at the particulars of this issue. We have to really look, what are we doing with this community fund and where's the money going? Because we've seen in this state that money has gone to places and we have yet to see the results. And maybe I might be on the island on this, but when we look at programs like the United Way Poverty Program, we have yet to see anything come out of RMAPI. We've seen a whole bunch of money invested at RMAPI, but we have yet to see actual things happen. And so what we need to do is we have to get together, get groups together, and actually invest in good programs, quality programs that we already know that works, quality programs like teen empowerment and the work they're doing, right, and the work they're trying to do to keep kids off the streets and the work they're trying to do to have kids be inspired and have a sense of agency, have a sense of self-sufficiency, right? And so we really need to ensure that we spend the tax revenue on this bill properly so we can actually do something and move the needle in this state and in this city.
Let me read a little bit of feedback on the subject of taxation and legalization. Rachel says, Evan, with the rampant corruption of New York State, I'm skeptical that tax money from weed will ever go to the right places. The New York Lotto is supposed to fund schools. How has that worked out? I'd almost rather just see marijuana decriminalized and unregulated. It seems like legalization is just a way for the wealthy to make even more. I do hope I'm wrong. That is Rachel in Rochester. I'd like some responses from the guests. Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, and that's really one of the main differences between the CRT and the MRT is that the tax revenue that, you know, the plan for the tax revenue in the CRT was to go into one, essentially a cannabis general fund, which was going to be allocated appropriately to whoever was elected in charge. And we know what happens when one person is in charge of all that money, which is why we, you know, our allies in the House and Senate made it very clear that if we do not earmark X percent of tax revenue towards community of color, we're going to shut it down. And lo and behold, the CRTA was shut down. So I think really being able to earmark and know exactly where the tax revenue is going right off the bat will be fundamental and really making sure that this tax revenue goes to the right people.
Okay, Mary?
And setting some, you know, provisions around like what those communities are and what they look like, and some language that's in this current version of the MRTA is that it would base it on like the number of people from the communities that have been arrested for marijuana-related offenses, and then would also look at like an increased street beat from the police, because a lot of these communities are communities that have higher police patrolling because they're communities that have more violence. So the police need to be there, but they don't need to be there arresting for low-level marijuana possession. And I lost my train of thought.
All right. Well, Rob Mohini, go ahead, Rob.
Yeah. Rephrase the question.
Well, I mean, this listener is concerned that New York State is just not really trustable, and that really all of this is a guise for the wealthy to make more, and that you can say you're going to distribute tax money. She's pointing to the lottery saying, I don't really trust that you're doing anything good with it, and I don't trust if you taxed and regulated marijuana, cannabis, that you would either. She just wants it decriminalized and unregulated entirely as a way to avoid what she thinks would be kind of the circumventing of good intention. What do you think, Rob?
I think we just got to do this and do this the right way. We know the MRTA is the right way to go, And so we got to push our state legislature. We got to push our representatives. We got to push the governor to do things the right way, or say that there's consequences. Maybe you don't get reelected, you know, because we really have to push the needle on this. And I say we need to go for what we know is right and do what we know is right. And if we don't do what's right, we see what happens. You know, we see that it shouldn't have to happen this way, but that's why Senator Robert Jackson had to take the New York City School District to court, right, to get the campaign for fiscal equity, because we were seeing, as Mulhaney said, that urban school districts are severely underfunded, right? And so he had to take it to court, right? Because we could not properly fund education like we fund everything else. And so we got to fund this, and we got to do it the right way, and we got to do it in a way that repairs community of color.
Yeah, Mulhaney, to Rachel, I mean, it sounds like Rob's point is that, yes, we've seen some missteps in the past, but that doesn't mean you give up at the gate. That from the outset, you learn from that and try to bring everybody to the table, and you safeguard against that sort of corruption. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely. And I think the answer to corruption is to have very well-organized communities that are paying attention to how this is being implemented so that we can hold our government accountable. And what I'd like to say is that, like, having a completely unregulated market is exactly what's going to make sure that the market in New York is taken over by corporations, actually goes to, you know, wealthier white people that have always had domination over our economy. It's going to leave workers behind. It's going to leave small business owners behind. It's going to block people of color that were previously associated, you know, with the marijuana industry from even entering the legal one. Having it be completely unregulated is exactly what's going to make Rachel's fears come true.
All right, let me get Dave on the phone next. Go ahead, Dave.
Hello.
Hi, Dave. Go ahead.
Oh, yes. Hello. This is Dave Telpa from Pittsburgh Pediatrics. How are you?
Go ahead. Go ahead, Dave.
Great. A quick question for the panelists. They support legalization, but I wonder how they plan on making sure that we protect another marginalized segment of society against the ill effects from it, namely children. My big concern is the edibles, where we have a number of stories on a monthly basis coming out of legalized states that involve children getting their hands on edibles, whether it's inadvertently as a toddler or as teenagers who are much better able to hide weed in brownies and other edibles that are readily available. I mean, in my opinion, I think edibles should not be legalized as part of the whole legalization movement, but I'd like to see how the proponents would work to prevent kids getting their hands on weed.
All right, Dr. Telpa, thank you. So are edibles, we assume, would be, there's probably quite a market for edibles if legalization happens, right? Yeah?
Yeah, I think edibles is kind of the main fear when it comes to children, and rightfully so, because, you know, we see a lot of it comes to, like, packaging regulations.
Looks kind of like gummies to me.
Gummies, yeah. I think I speak on behalf of both organizations, is that none of us want to see cannabis products in the hands of children. That's the last thing we want to see. But we also have to take into account social responsibility and accountability and education. You know, all these fears that we're worried about people, you know, children getting their hands on edibles are the same fear that when we talk about what about firearms in the home or dangerous pharmaceuticals or, you know, sugary cereals, right? All these things that are known to have public health issues, we need to teach people. You know, when are we going to start, you know, talking about endocannabinoid education in science classes and teaching people this is what happens when you consume cannabis at a young age? So I think it's a combination of education at a young age and also proper packaging requirements.
So should there be restrictions on packaging? If these just look like gummy bears, is that a problem?
Yeah, I think that, I mean, what the actual food looks like, I think that's a different conversation than what the packaging looks like.
Sure.
I think the packaging 100% needs to be child resistant. It needs to not be marketed in a way towards children. Like, I saw something recently where there was a commercial that Cookie Monster was used to try and promote an edible. And, like, us as an organization, we're against that type of advertisement and direct marketing towards children. And I think that's a real benefit of New York, of waiting after 10 states plus D.C. have legalized, as we've seen what other states have done wrong, and we don't want to follow suit of that. So definitely keeping it out of children's hands is a concern of ours, but we have to look at the data that we have and recognize that in states that have legalized, even though they've messed up in ways, we haven't seen an increase in youth use. There has not been a significant increase in any state that has legalized. And so it just reminds me a lot of the Reefer Madness era. You know, it's going to be like the demon of the youth. And it's we really need to look at the data that we have and think about what are we afraid of.
Okay. Mohini and Rob, what do you think?
Yeah, I think the facts are in front of us. We've talked about it. Is this like regulating guns? Is this like proper packaging? And so we can't be scared into a less progressive bill. We can't let these sort of scare tactics scare us into less progressive bill. We all believe that it should not be out of the kids of the hands of children. And as said earlier, proper packaging, proper marketing can regulate that. And we should not let these type of concerns scare us into making the bill less progressive.
Okay. I agree with that, Mohini.
I do. I think everyone has said anything I would have said very well.
She's co-signing. After our only break of the hour, we're going to come back and get more into some of the other proposals that we briefly talked about, where there's the idea that there should be kind of affirmative action licensing. Who does get the licensing? Who's in the door in the first place? And how do you make sure that the people who are going to be reaping the initial profits aren't sort of monolithically white, and what it would require to do that, and whether New York's legislation addresses that sufficiently. Our guests are talking about what economic justice means in the event of marijuana, recreational marijuana legalization. Mohini Sharma and Rob Hargard are here from Metro Justice, Mary Krueger, Steve Van de Waal from Rock Normal, and more of your feedback in our second half hour as well. Coming up in our second hour, a conversation about what it means to be gifted and talented. Teachers nominate students, there are different metrics and measurements, but Dr. Donna Ford from Vanderbilt University is visiting Rochester today with a message. She says too often, students of color are left out of discussions about what it means to be gifted. Her proposals for changing the system next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Right on cue, we were talking about sort of the strength of some of this, and here is Angela writing to us just asking about the strength of marijuana. Angela says, the strength of some of these products is way beyond what we had when I was growing up, if I would have been doing this when I was growing up, she says. But does that mean that companies that create these products have to use less cannabis because it's stronger? Are they cutting it? What are the products like today? Angela, it's a good question. And we were just kind of talking during our brief break about some of the strength of certain products, edible or otherwise. What do we know about the strength, Steve?
Yeah, I mean, now that we have 10 states plus D.C. that are regulated and are actually allowed to have, like, strong agricultural and horticulture programs, we can now start to, like, genetically modify or have, you know, grow these strains for high in THC or much higher THC levels than you would historically have, you know, a decade or two decades ago. And personally, I believe that there, you know, not on the behalf of the organization, that I think there should not be some THC limits on some of these products. Like we were talking about during the break, I had stumbled upon this product ad for a brownie edible out in Colorado, and this was 1,000 milligrams of THC in one brownie. And while yes, they only recommend taking a bite at a time, it's like if you know. Consuming 1,000 milligrams of THC, like, you're going to have some serious side effects. So it's like we need to be able to set restrictions. I'm not necessarily sure what those restrictions are, but I think those will be things that as the industry matures, we'll really be able to iron out some of these issues.
All right. Well, thank you for that, Angela. It's not something that I had thought too much about. On the subject of who's in the door in the first place, we have seen Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, a member of Congress, calling for affirmative action licensing for entrepreneurs of color in the marijuana industry. So that's separate from a community fund. That's separate from what do we do with the tax money. That says who gets in the door in the first place. Are we seeing that? Mohini, Rob, do we see that in New York State yet? And do you support affirmative action licensing?
Yes, Metro Justice certainly does. I know that the Start Smart Coalition and the Marijuana Regulation and Taxation Act also put provisions forth that say that there should be priority licensing for communities of color, for people that have already been engaged in the industry, in order to make sure that access to the industry is truly equitable and isn't actually harming people or excluding people that have been a part of this and would have had access to it a long time ago if marijuana prohibition hadn't lasted so long.
Okay. Rob, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, Mohini stole the show. I agree with everything she said. You know, we have to look at this bill, look at what's going on, and see how can we regulate it in a way that inclusion and diversity is actually values that are reflected in this bill, right? Because we've seen in so many different ways that black and brown people have been sidelined in so many different ways. And we don't want yet another bill to come change things, but not change it for communities of color. And so that's important that we have this in place so that wealthy white donors just don't run away with this industry and things just stay the same.
Okay. Mary?
Agree with everything they've said. And then beyond the priority licensing, it's important to look at how we're going to set up this licensing structure. So when we look at the MRTA, we have a multi-tier licensing structure. So like we had talked about before, there's a lot of different ways that you can get into the industry, whether it's cultivation, distribution, whereas there's another model that can be followed that is vertical integration. So that's how we currently have our medical marijuana market set up in New York. And vertical integration requires you to have upwards of $6 million to even have a chance at industry ownership. And that's one business holding all of the licenses from seed to sale, as opposed to the multi-tier licensing. So it's really important that we talk about that too when we're looking at building an equitable industry, because even if we have low or no interest loans that are being supported by the state, they're never going to be $6 million for an individual or for a team of people. And so we look at how the medical marijuana market was created in New York, and it was very exclusionary. It was very, you have to be a millionaire to get industry ownership. And we want to make sure that the current medical license holders have a place in the adult use market, but we want to be very sure that they don't come in and get to take over from the beginning, because then that makes it impossible for small businesses and for actual equity to get created in the industry.
Okay. Steve, want to add to that?
Yeah, I agree with what everybody said. And I also think that, you know, along with having an equitable industry, we need to be able to provide resources, like I said before, that help to catalyze the success of this industry. You know, you could have an entire team of growers or extractors or manufacturers or retail shops, but this industry is very complex. And the only way that you can survive as a small business with one single license is in a collaborative manner. So we need to bring the industry experts to the table, the cultivation experts, the legal experts, attorneys, compliance people, retail experts, and be able to create, you know, bring these people to the table and say, how can we use our resources to bring you all together to create a powerful, equitable, and inclusive industry?
Okay. Let me get to Robert in Fairport on the phone next. Go ahead, Robert.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. It seems that part of the rationale for legalizing this in the first place is to not lock people up and arrest them for using and selling marijuana. But some of your panelists have been using the word illicit several times in this conversation, and that suggests that maybe you're just trading one illegality for another, and that would be the sale of marijuana that's untaxed. And it would seem to put these people in a position that they're trying to evade taxes, and they may be subject to laws pertaining to tax evasion. I just wonder if they're just trading one criminal type of activity for another.
All right, Robert, thank you for the phone call. Thoughts on that?
I think we're trying to really readjust the language around this industry as a whole. You know, notoriously that the language has been black market, but this is a social justice issue. And the more that we keep using this black and white language, the more that we're going to continue to drive a wedge between these communities. Illicit is just much more of a universal, more politically correct way of us saying illegal.
Yeah, and I think he's going back to the comment that Steve was making earlier, which is that the higher the level of taxes, there's a tipping point at some point in which you're going to see things go on to more of an illicit market to avoid what would look like sort of heavy-handed government taxation. So what our guests are talking about is finding sort of that equilibrium, a taxation level that isn't going to drive illicit activity, but also enough taxation to generate funds and possible wealth or resources for communities that have been disproportionately impacted by prosecution, arrests, et cetera. So I don't necessarily see, Robert, the idea that everyone's just going to dodge taxes on this, but you know, I guess probably depends on the level of it.
Go ahead.
I think that instead of looking at like trading one crime for another, like Robert was saying, is that we more see the state respond in a way and say, we messed up and we need to change the regulations that we created. That's what California just did. They overtaxed their new adult use market and they had to take a step back and restructure how they've taxed. So we actually are working really close. We have a legal attorney, Jason Klimak, who works with our chapter, and he sits on the New York State Bar Association for Cannabis Law. And he's submitted comments directly to Crystal People Stokes' office about the tax pieces. So it's something that we're looking at really, really closely, and what other states have done right and what they've done wrong and how New York State can find that equilibrium. And we're really confident and hopeful in the work that Jason and Assemblymember People Stokes' office are doing.
Okay.
And to piggyback off that, here's the reality. We've been buying cannabis for the last 80 years. Okay. Now that more and more states are becoming legal, especially the states around us, Massachusetts, Maine, not only is cannabis, are we going to have better access to cannabis of more varieties and of higher quality and cheaper, but if New York, you know, comes in with a legal recreational program and taxes the heck out of it, of course we're just going to, you know, retreat to the illicit market. So it's like we are now in a very unique situation as New York is that we're kind of becoming surrounded by these legal markets where it becomes very easy for cannabis to find its way here to the consumer. So as a consumer, whether we legalize today or we legalize in 50 years, we're always going to have it. It's going to be plentiful. It's going to be quality, right? Because it's coming from these quality markets. So New York has the opportunity to come in here and say, okay, what is that perfect tax threshold where we can extract the perfect amount of money to really benefit these communities without driving people away from the legal market? So it's a science and an art. My fear is that historically New York is going to throw a huge tax on it, and they're going to wonder, you know, you guys were talking about all this tax revenue that was supposed to be generated from this industry, but not only have we not seen a lot of tax revenue, but there's a rise in the illicit market. Well, that's what happens when you tax something that we've been using for the last 80 years. So it's a balancing act.
Okay, Rob? Yeah,
and to add to Steve, you know, we really have to look at that closely, because when you look at our state, and the research shows that our state is one of the worst states in the country for how we tax, right? And so when you look at sales tax, when you look at all the property tax, when you look at all these taxes, we have to really look at that closely. How are we taxing folks? Because we have a system built on transactions. We tax folks based on transactions. We don't tax folks based on their wealth, but a transaction. And so what we have to really look at is how are we going to tax this industry properly and not overtax it, because we can actually make this problem worse if we actually overtax and create and keep the system the way it's been in the last decade.
Okay. All right. Let's get Tom in Brighton next on the phone. Go ahead, Tom.
Yeah, we currently have a lot of laws on the books, you know, very strong laws about anti-discrimination with penalties. You can't specify that you're going to give a job to someone based on their color or some other benefit like that. So if we are to try to get income or revenue from this to go into communities of color, how do we effectively do that without creating a lot of litigation? Because I can see the lawyers lining up to sue companies or even localities, municipalities, that attempt to direct the money to communities based on color, when on the books there are laws that specifically prohibit that.
Okay, hang there for a second, Tom. I want to make sure we're following the question correctly. Mary, you want to start there? You were doing the job.
Yeah, I was going to say that in the MRTA, it doesn't specifically limit it to neighborhoods that are people of color. It says these low-income neighborhoods that have been directly targeted in the war on drugs. And what does it look like to be directly targeted in the war on drugs? We're looking at the number of arrests that have been made for low-level marijuana possession. And if you look at the data, it's extremely concentrated into not even just certain cities, but certain neighborhoods within those cities. So that's where the tax revenue is being allocated to, not just communities that are people of color. It just so happens that those are the same communities.
Yeah, Mohini, you want to jump in on that? No? Okay. So, Tom, does that address it? I mean, I'm trying to make sure we understand the point you're making.
Yeah, you largely addressed it, but there's still a lot of people who are consumers, users of marijuana, who don't necessarily reside in those specific communities. Mm-hmm. They're not going to be served.
So it's not a matter of being served. It's a matter of where the tax revenue is going. And
that's what I mean by serving.
Okay, so it's saying that the community reinvestment grants, that money is going to go specifically to those communities. And so when we look at who you know, definitely white people from the suburbs have been arrested for low-level marijuana possession. But the majority of people, like Mohini said earlier, if we look at from 2010 to 2018, what Mohini was at 92% of the arrests were people of color from Rochester.
Yes, they were.
So that's extremely disproportionate when we look and see that folks across all races consume cannabis at the same rates. And we actually see that white folks consume cannabis at higher rates. So everyone's going to benefit from this. And when we pump money into these low-income communities that are poverty-stricken, it ripples out into every other part of the community, not just the inner city.
But to be blunt here, you know, Tom, you're right. If you're a wealthy person smoking a joint on a couch in Pittsford, your community is not really targeted with the taxes with this. And the idea is that there's a reason for that. I mean, I'm just being blunt. Is that fair, Mohini?
Yeah, definitely.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, so, you know, like Mary said, that marijuana use and sale and distribution, like, there's no significant difference between black communities and white communities, wealthy communities, low-income communities, yet the majority of the policing and arrests are happening in communities of color, particularly urban communities of color, which also tend to be poor thanks to our racist history of redlining. And therefore, like, if there have been certain communities that have been targeted by the war on drugs, and now you're going to legalize marijuana, dealing a significant blow to that war on drugs, that has to include reparations to the communities that have been devastated by this, especially because it doesn't just stop at police brutality and police arrests. These records go on to prevent these people from getting jobs, from getting access to housing, from getting access to public benefits. So when it comes to reinvesting this tax revenue, why would you reinvest it in places that don't need it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, Mohini used the word reparations, and I know some can be sensitive about the term. Do you view this as a form of reparations if this sort of a plan goes through?
If reparations mean socially and economically making up for the harm that our institutions and our government and our systems have inflicted disproportionately on a certain population, low income and people of color, then yes, absolutely. Like, we need to make up for that. We need to pay for the harm that we caused. You know, when it comes to policing these communities, suddenly the money appears, right? When it comes to fighting foreign wars on other countries of color, suddenly the money appears, and we're fine with the tax revenue going there. But when it comes to the communities that we've directly harmed at home, suddenly there's all this resistance to, like, that tax revenue going there. And it just, I'm absolutely someone that thinks that reparations are necessary, and they're necessary in a way that brings up low income and people of color communities, especially when they are going to be participating in this industry.
Okay.
I see it as a form of reparations too. But since the 1800s, communities of color have been boxed out. You know, descendants of slaves have been boxed out. And so this bill is a starting point to say we've boxed out community colors for years and we punished them for years. This is a way for us to turn the tide and do things differently and actually see it where we're making an equitable system for all, right? And so that's what we need to do. Now, I think reparations is the bigger conversation is differently. And, you know, I personally think that we should just take everyone who's a descendant of slaves and split up money and just, you know, and we should do it that way. Because when we look at the economic sort of impact that has happened to people who are descendants of slaves, and when we also look at the mental health impact of folks who have been targeted since from slavery to New Jim Crow to everything, right? We have to start. And this is a bill, if we do it the right way, we do it the way People Stokes says, we do it this the right way, we can actually start to turn the tide and make this system equitable for all.
Mohini?
Yeah, and you know, when it comes to this reparations question, the fact is that the wealth of this country is built on the exploitation of workers, it's built on the imprisonment and arrest of people of color, and is built on waging needless wars abroad, especially of countries of color. So we have this immense wealth built in this country that rests on a history of white supremacism and imperialism and colonization. So if we're actually going to make a dent in that by legalizing marijuana, then that money that we made profiteering, like, as a country off the backs of people of color now needs to go back to them.
And I'll just add to that for the white folks out there that are feeling some white fragility, don't worry, there is an excess tax that the county can impose as well, and then can choose how they want to spend it themselves. So we're just talking about state tax. The county can then tax a little bit more if you want the tax revenue to go back into your communities.
Down to our last minute, let me ask both sides of the table for a quick 30 seconds. What do you want to see next going forward as we talk about recreational legalization of marijuana in the state? Mohini Sharma.
To me, the major question of economic justice is also putting the interests of workers first. Because at the end of the day, in any economy, most people are going to be workers, not business owners. So when we legalize the industry, we need to make sure that workers have unionizing rights, that these shops are friendly to union representatives coming in, and that they have the right to organize so that these are good jobs with benefits, with living wages that can actually bring these communities forward. And especially when it comes to cultivation, what we see is that the majority of workers are women and are women of color and are immigrants. So these workers need to have the right to organize and stand up for their rights.
Okay. From the folks from Rock Normal, thoughts from you on what you want to see next going forward here?
I want to see a bill as close to the MRTA get passed in this legislative session. But most importantly, I want to see some action taken here at the local level. We have the unanimous support from city council. We have vocal support from the mayor, but we need the mayor to step up and to work with us to make sure that this community and our community is included in this industry. That goes for our county executive, Cheryl Denolfo. That goes for our district attorney, Sandra Dorley. All the people that are decision makers, we need to opt in, and we need to make sure that Rochester is not left out of this industry.
I want to thank our guests for the hour, Mohini Sharma and Robert Hoggard from Metro Justice. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And our thanks to Steve Vandewall, Mary Kruger from Rock Normal. Thank you for being here as well.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Listeners, this conversation, part of a series of reporting about the potential impact of marijuana legalization in New York State. You can find a lot more stories and videos at WXXINews.org. More connections coming up.